Good afternoon. Welcome once again to Line One, your health connection from Alaska Public Media in Anchorage, Alaska. I'm your co-host, Dr. Thad Woodard. If you really sit down and think about it a little bit, like I did for this introduction, modern humans evolved about 200,000 years ago, but our immediate environment has hardly changed until the onset of, let's say, the Industrial Revolution about 250 years ago. Antibiotics, plastics, gasoline, and in fact, much of what we are exposed to in our everyday environment did not even exist, let's say, 100 years ago. So each day, our genes, our skin, our respiratory tract, our intestines, our brains are exposed to relatively new substances compared to most of our 200,000 years of history. What are the effects on our health of these relatively recent changes in our environment? Today on Line One, we're going to discuss some concerns about our environment's impact on health. And joining me to do this is Pam Miller. She's Executive Director of the Alaska Community Action on Toxics, who is in the studio today. And on the phone is David O. Carpenter, MD. He's Director of the Institute for Health and the Environment at the University at Albany, part of the, I think, the New York University, State University of New York, if I'm saying that pretty badly to begin with. So welcome to both of you. And then let me remind listeners, if you can reach us today with any questions or comments that you have in Anchorage, our number is 550-8433. That's 550-8433. We have an email address, line1@alaskapublic.org, and call toll-free at any time also, 1-888-353-5752. So I kind of butchered the ending of that. Pam, welcome to Line 1, and Dr. Carpenter, welcome. Dr. Carpenter is joining us on the telephone, by the way.
Thanks, Dr. Woodard.
Thank you very much.
Nice to have you here. Let's start today by talking about what each of you guys do, really. So tell us about the Alaska Community Action on Toxics.
Okay, sure. So we are a nonprofit environmental health and justice research and advocacy organization. We've been in existence since 1997, really in response to a lot of community requests for assistance to do community-based participatory research to understand the environmental and health effects of contamination from such sources as military, mining, and other industrial sources, as well as long-range transport, because we know the Arctic in Alaska is a hemispheric sink for global transport of chemicals that migrate on wind and ocean currents into our region.
All right. And David, you are a researcher at the University at Albany, part of the state system of New York University. If I'm still not saying that right, but you can maybe clarify that.
Well, you got it pretty well right. It's one of the campuses of the State University of New York.
Okay. And you've been involved in environmental toxicology and so forth for a number of years and researched on a number of issues. So if you don't mind kind of telling us a little bit about yourself and particularly your current interests.
Well, I've been involved in study of chemical effects on the brain, on the whole body for many, many years. I used to do exclusively animal research, but now I do exclusively human research. And I've worked with PAM and ACOT almost from the beginning of their organization. My major interests are environmental factors of human disease. So if you're exposed to chemical X, what does that do to your health? And I've looked at a variety of chemicals, certainly started with looking at chemicals that affect IQ and memory effects. Now I'm really looking at almost all of the diseases, including the chronic diseases of older age, like heart disease and respiratory disease and diabetes, and studying what exposure to chemicals does to one's risk of developing these diseases.
The first thing I guess I'd like to ask you is, as a physician, and a little bit it's my bias towards trying to understand how we know what we know, I think of this as very, very difficult work to do. It's a very good science. It's very difficult. It's easy to find associations, but cause and effect. And I have to say I was an epidemiologist at one point in my life. I came up here at the CDC as a medical epidemiologist, so I have some background of this. How do you view this job that you have at really nailing down a cause and effect as best you can, and then getting something done about it, which is a whole different ball of wax, the advocacy aspects?
Well, you're right on the ball on that, because all we can do is look for associations. In other words, we can say that people that have more exposure to this chemical have more of this disease. And that, of course, there can be many explanations for why that association would exist. It doesn't necessarily mean that the chemical caused the disease. One thing that I've been so caught up in my studies is that poor people have greater exposure to chemicals, and poor people have more disease. So it's very difficult to sort out what is caused by poverty, by lifestyle, by what you eat, where you live, and how much that relates to what exposures you have. So if you demonstrate that certain people have more high blood pressure, for example, than other people, is that because they're exposed to a specific chemical? And we've got some results that show that there's a strong relation between exposure to chemicals, in this case polychlorinated biphenyls, and high blood pressure. But we always have to ask the question, is it really the chemical, or is it because these people eat a poorer diet, they don't exercise as much, they have other habits like smoking that is more common in a poorer people than more wealthy people? And it's, of course, often difficult to do adequate control for these, what we call confounders. But that's the nature of this kind of research, and that's what we try to do.
Mm-hmm. Pam, before we came on the air, we talked a little bit about another somewhat important principle of toxicology, and that's the time at which an exposure may occur. You may want to talk about that. It might not seem important, but it may make a lot of difference depending on the chemical, if it happens in utero or after birth or at age 70 years of age, as to what effects that something may have.
Absolutely. I think there really is a much greater understanding of these critical windows of development, and a developing child is very vulnerable to exposure because many of the environmental chemicals that might be present in the mother's body can cross the placenta. And then once the child is born, the child may also be exposed through breast milk mm-hmm. to a number of contaminants that could be of mm-hmm. concern for that child's development.
Mm-hmm. You have any further ways you'd like to expand on that idea, Dr. Carpenter, that the importance of that early time of development of children?
Yes, that's really an extraordinarily important area, and it's an area of very active research. It's called the fetal origins of disease, and this came from work from a scientist in the UK, David Barker, who reported that the exposures that individuals have before birth determine their risk of developing things like high blood pressure and diabetes and heart disease, and the diseases we think of as being diseases of old age. But they're influenced by the exposures that an unborn fetus gets from what's in their mother's body. And this is really extraordinarily important. When you think about it, it isn't really all that difficult to imagine, because during development, the cells in the body are dividing rapidly, the organization of the body structures are that's when it occurs. And so this whole question of how much of the diseases we have in old age or middle age or whatever, how much is that because of what our mother was exposed to? It's very exciting and a little bit disturbing, because so much of the disease that we see in adult populations are these chronic diseases: diabetes, heart disease, respiratory disease. And this evidence suggests that, yes, what your mother and your grandmother were exposed to can influence your risk of developing these diseases.
Let me remind listeners once again, if you're listening today, you're listening to Line One, your health connection. Today we're talking about environmental health issues with Dr. David O. Carpenter. He's director of the Institute for Health and the Environment at the University of Albany, and Pam Miller, who's executive director of Alaska Community Action on Toxics. Our local number for any calls or questions or comments, 550-8433, 550-8433, our email address, line1@alaskapublic.org. I've been really very much interested in this whole idea of the Barker hypothesis, the fetal origin of disease. And I think when you first hear that, and if you're not experienced and you don't have some understanding of the mechanism, it really seems very, very far-fetched. My recollection is that some of the original ideas and thoughts about this originated from some of the issues with starvation. I think it was in the people in Holland during the war and their offspring and how it affected the growth compared to other families that did not go through the same starvation. And people really began to look at this. And at least in pediatrics, we now put a lot of faith in that, because we're beginning to, we really also understand, if we take one organ, let's just take the brain, for example, and I talk about this daily with families. Our brains, you get 80% of your adult head size by age two. And again, I'm going through this to just help people understand why this early origin could have lifelong effects. So you get 80% of your adult head size by age two, and you're not developing more cells. Those cells that are there are not getting bigger. The reason your brain grows or the head size grows is you're developing more and more dendrites that are connecting to other cells. And the reason that happens is stimulation. So what happens in our environment is affecting all of these things. And we know if a kid, a child is born that can't see or can't hear, then certain parts of the brain don't develop. And actually the cells are pruned away because the body doesn't want to use energy on that. And then here's the other concept that helps me get parents to understand this, is our brains are wonderful at learning, and they learn very well, particularly at the beginning of life. They are not very good at unlearning. So you can't tell me how to unlearn how to ride a bike, for example. And when you tell people that, they begin to understand, yeah, okay, so that very first 2 years of life, when there's a lot going on that's not very changeable, begins to make sense. And that, in a sense, is true with our chemical exposures, our environmental influences, and all other respects. So I've bought into this. I think it's extremely important. And as we look at chronic diseases more and more, not just infectious diseases, we're beginning to recognize these origins. Is that how you understand?
One other thing to that, because in fact, all of us lose more nerve cells after about age two.
Yep.
And, you know, the brain prunes the nerve cells, and more go away than we generate new ones. So it's not really surprising that things that happen in before birth and in the first couple of years of life really reflect, at least in our brain, what our capability is for the rest of our life.
And added on top of this, at least from a chemical standpoint, is that things we're exposed to, we now know environmental issues, very environmental things, but I'm just thinking chemicals now, can directly influence our genetics, our genes, our and what's called the epigenome, and so that food can affect what our epigenome knows and what, and lots of chemicals. So it's gotten unbelievably complex, yet at the same time, the mechanisms by which all this can happen has become fairly clear.
Well, that's very important. This whole exciting area of epigenetics, it's an area where it isn't that you get a mutation of your DNA, which we've understood for a long time. When the human genome was really elucidated, everybody thought, well, this would explain every disease. Well, it turns out it doesn't at all, because this whole epigenetic thing, which is primarily changes in the DNA by methylation that are quite reversible, but they may take several generations to reverse. So what your grandmother and grandfather did may actually affect your susceptibility, your risk of various diseases. And this is an exciting area, but it certainly adds to the complexity of our trying to understand the origin of human disease.
All right. Pam, back to you, back to Alaska, or the Community Action on Toxics. Where is the funding coming? How do you guys keep yourself going, and what are the specific things you're doing, working on right now? Those are questions that come to my mind.
Sure, good questions. Well, we have three basic sources of funding. We're funded by the public. We have membership. We all foundation support. And then we have one source of federal funding, which is through the National Institutes of Health, specifically the National Institute of Environmental Health Sciences, that helps support the project that David and I are collaborating on, which is a collaborative community-based participatory research project with the communities on St. Lawrence Island called Protecting Future Generations. And in that project, we're investigating exposures that people have, particularly people of childbearing age, to toxic chemicals through indoor exposures, through environmental exposures, because of the concerns people have out there because of the military contamination, long-range transport of chemical contaminants that are contaminating traditional food sources. So we're looking at a range of exposures to two primary classes of chemicals: perfluorinated chemicals, which are known as the stain-resistant chemicals that are found in everyday applications such as Teflon and pots and pans and fabrics that have stain-resistant capacities, and then a class of chemicals known as flame retardants, or the polybrominated diphenyl ethers. And both of those classes of chemicals are highly persistent. They are transported in the Arctic, but there are also local sources of them, and they can affect people at very low doses, particularly children. And the polybrominated diphenyl ethers, or the PBDE flame retardants, for example, can affect thyroid and brain development at very low concentrations. So we're especially concerned about the effects of these chemicals on people of childbearing age, as well as especially children.
Mm-hmm. So that's how you two got to know each other, through this cooperative work out on St. Lawrence Island?
Yes. We were approached, really, Alaska Community Action on Toxics was approached early on by a former health aide and elder named Annie Aloha, who was very concerned about the health disparities that she was witnessing on the island, diseases that she had never seen before in her people. And there were two formerly used defense sites on the island that had high concentrations of fuels, solvents, PCBs, and pesticides. So we began by investigating that, doing environmental studies, doing studies of concentrations in biological organisms, and then at the request of the communities, looking at levels in people. And indeed, we found elevated levels of PCBs, and perhaps David can speak more about that.
Well, PCBs, you know, they're a man-made chemical. They were first made in the U.S. in about 1929. And they were quite useful because they were not very flammable, and they were good electrical insulators. So they were used in electrical capacitors and transformers. But they also, for many years, were used as the solvent for oil-based paints. They were used as a solvent for window caulking. They were used for water-resistant things in cookware that they got replaced by these perfluorinated compounds, which are equally bad. But in any case, all of us have these in our body, every person on the face of the earth. And it was really remarkable for us when we began to look at the people that live on St. Lawrence Island, which is about as remote a place as you can find. We find that they have levels in their blood and in their bodies that are comparable to those that people in the lower 48 that live in very contaminated waste sites that I've been studying for 30 years. And, you know, these people never benefited at all from the use of these compounds. The source appears to be primarily through their diet, because Alaska natives eat a lot of marine mammal fat, and these chemicals, the PCBs and the pesticides like DDT, they are fat soluble. They accumulate in body fat, and so they accumulate in whale, seal, and walrus. And the fat of those animals are a major part of the diet, which results in levels of contamination on St. Lawrence Island that are comparable to those of the people in Anniston, Alabama, where the plant that manufactured PCBs by the Anniston, by the Monsanto Chemical Company exists. And also by the Native American Mohawk tribe at Akwesasne, which I've worked with for many, many years, that live downstream from aluminum foundries operated by General Motors, by Alcoa, by Reynolds Metals, and they use PCBs as hydraulic fluids, and when they leaked, they washed them into the down the drain, and they went into the St. Lawrence River, and these people had fish as their primary protein source. So it's a really a strong case of environmental injustice that this population in a remote part of the world that never benefited from any of these developments are as exposed as anybody in the face of the earth to chemicals that cause a whole variety of different diseases. And the diseases we've documented are reduced IQ of children and adults, interference with hormonal systems, increased risk of heart disease, increased risk of diabetes, you name it, there's some association with these exposures to these chemicals.
And I guess the one thing I'd like to add is that we're not just doing science for science sake, that we try to bring this science to bear for policy changes, whether that's holding the military accountable for responsible cleanup or changing policy at a state, national, or international level to prevent these kinds of harmful exposures. But we do find that the science really strengthens, in many cases, the case that we have to inform and change policy so that we can get more protective standards. Because I think there has been a revolution in the science of environmental health over the last several years, and we're now understanding that it's not, as you pointed out, not as simplistic. Things are very complicated. It's not any longer just the dose makes the poison. Right. These chemicals have effects at exquisitely low concentrations. There are endocrine and epigenetic considerations, multi-generational effects of these chemicals. And so our system of law is very outdated. So in order to establish protective standards, I think we also need to change the system of law that we're operating under. So, for instance, the Toxic Substances Control Act came about in 1976 before much of this science was really understood. There has been a recent amended version of TSCA. It was the only major environmental law that hadn't been amended, and we're not completely satisfied with that, but it's much more protective than the prior version of the law. And we have to keep working because people, for example, on St. Lawrence Island should simply not be exposed to these harmful chemicals that come into their environment without their consent.
So as a former epidemiologist, when you've got an island, especially fairly secluded island, it makes it an odd, ideal kind of place to try to do science or associate and stuff. So the thought that comes to my mind is it appears that the evidence is pretty good that the PCBs and many of these chemicals are coming through diet. And so the logical question is, how did these marine animals become carriers of the toxins? Is it something on the island that is leaching out from, let's say, the military presence in the past? Or is this an Arctic inclusive issue for some reason? What do we know about those sources in the animals?
Well, we certainly found elevated levels of PCBs and other contaminants in and around the military formerly used defense site at Northeast Cape on St. Lawrence Island. I think the levels of contaminants that we're finding in traditional foods, such as the marine mammals that are migratory in nature, that have long lives, that accumulate these contaminants over time, a lot of that contamination is coming through long-range transport and accumulated over the life of the fish or marine mammal that we're we're analyzing.
David, what do you have to add about these the work that was being done?
Well, I agree with Pam. I think we've looked very carefully trying to answer that question. That was the initial question that we asked in our research efforts. And it's clear that both are important. I think the more important one is the atmospheric transport. So the use of these chemicals in Asia, in North America, in temperate climates, they volatilize, they go into the air goes to the cold polar region, they come out of the air, they then get accumulated in the food supply. Now, the bowhead whale, which is a major source of food consumption, is migratory, relatively migratory, but not that migratory relative to other whales. The seal and the walrus are not so migratory. But these chemicals come to the polar regions. They concentrate there. They precipitate. And this adds to the sense of injustice, because why would people that live in one of the most pristine parts of the world have such high contaminants? It's to a great degree this migration from temperate regions, but there also is a contribution from these military sites. So the Northeast Cape doesn't have any permanent settlement, but we looked at the blood in people from the village of Gamble that had hunting camps in the Northeast Cape. And those people had higher levels of PCBs in their body than the people that lived at Gamble but that didn't have hunting camps at the Northeast Cape, or people living in I was talking about Savungan, not Gamble, or the comparison group was people living in Gamble. So the military bases contribute, although I think we still concluded that the most important source was atmospheric transport.
And the other thing that's kind of implicit in what you're saying, and I assume it's correct, is that these chemicals do not break down very rapidly. They have extremely long half-lives, and so that once present, we're not going to get rid of them anytime soon.
Well, that's absolutely correct. And, you know, these chemicals, the PCBs, are in fact 209 different chemicals. And how long they stay in the human body does vary with how many chlorines there are on the body. But on average, if you ate a contaminated fish or whale or seal or whatever last night, you'll still have half of those chemicals in your body between 5 and 10 years later.
Are there, this is just me thinking, is there any population in the world where people have looked and have not found significant evidence of exposure to these chemicals?
The short answer is no.
Yeah.
No, nobody in the face of the earth has no PCBs. Now, of course, the sensitivity of your assay is important in answering that question, and we all have people that have levels below our detection limit, but they've spread all over the face of the earth, in the most remote areas, in, you know, the jungles of South America and Africa, because they go into the air and they distribute around the earth.
And they're not naturally occurring chemicals.
To get to
my my introduction a little bit, this is a relatively new exposure to our long evolved genetic system of protection. So
nobody had them in their body before 1929.
We're not geared up to recognize or do stuff about this theoretically. Yep. I'm sorry, Pam. You were going to say something.
Sure. I think it is important to recognize that people of the Arctic, particularly indigenous peoples who rely on traditional foods, are among the most highly exposed people on Earth. Okay. And this was recognized in the negotiation and signing of an international legally binding convention called the Stockholm Convention, which is a convention designed to phase out the world's most dangerous chemicals, in part because of the very, very high exposures that peoples of the Arctic have to these chemicals and the supreme injustice of that. And so we're working at the international level because we recognize these chemicals don't have political boundaries, and it's important not only to work at the local level and address problems that people have in schools through work with local school boards and things like that, that's absolutely necessary. But because of the global nature of the chemical contamination problem and the special vulnerability of Arctic, we feel it's also necessary to work at that level.
And to go back to what we were talking about earlier, these chemicals, the PCBs and the pesticides, they reduce IQ. As we talked about earlier, the critical period for the development of the brain is prenatally in the first couple of years of life. They also, early life exposure increases the risk of some of the diseases of older age. They increase the chance you'll be obese. They increase the chance that you'll develop diabetes and heart disease. So all these epigenetic events apply to these chemicals, which makes the tragedy of the exposure of Alaskan Native people that never benefited from any of this, it makes it even more outrageous. And outrageous is really the right word.
I'm going to take we normally take a break. I want to take that break right now. We have a caller that's holding on. When I ask that person to hold on, and we'll come back and take that call as soon as we can. But what I want to remind listeners again, one more time, you're listening to Line One, Your Health Connection. Our local number again today is 550-8433, 550-8433. Toll-free number 1-888-353-5752. And our email address is line1@alaskapublic.org. We're going to take a one-minute break, and we'll continue our discussion with Pam Miller and Dr. David Carpenter on environmental factors affecting human health. I'm Dr. Thad Woodard.
You're listening to Line One from Alaska Public Media. The program repeats tonight at 8 p.m. on KSKA Anchorage and will not be taking phone calls. You can find Line One on iTunes or listen at alaskapublic.org.
All right, welcome back. This is Line One, Your Health Connection from Alaska Public Media in Anchorage, Alaska, and I'm your host, Dr. Thad Woodard. My guests today are Pam Miller. She's Executive Director of the Alaska Community Action on Toxics, who's in our studio, and then joining us by phone is Dr. David Carpenter, MD. He is Director of the Institute for Health and Environment at the University at Albany, part of the State University of New York Health Educational System. We've had a very interesting discussion up to this point about environmental influences on health. We've talked about PCBs, which many people who are at least aware of public health issues should have heard that term before, and talked a little bit about the complexity of making really clear cause and effect kind of data, and we often have to just work on the closest and best associations that we can to try to affect change, which gets into this whole issue of regulation and policy work. And we've been talking about some work that both Dr. Carpenter and Pam Miller and her organization have been doing at on St. Paul Island, associated with some PCBs.
St. Lawrence Island.
St. Lawrence. I said St. Paul. Yeah, different island. You can email questions to us at line1@alaskapublic.org. You can call us locally at 550-8433. Our toll-free number, 1-888-353-5752. And please remember, if you're listening between 8 and 9 p.m. on a Monday evening, that's a taped rebroadcast, and we won't be able to answer your questions. So if you've got questions or comments, you've got about 25 minutes to use those numbers again to let us know. Again, email line1@alaskapublic.org and our local number, 550-8433. Hazel, you've been holding on. You got a question. What can I do for you?
Well, I'd like to ask about the stuff where you're saying it's coming from other parts of the planet and coming up here and poisoning the foods up here. And you mentioned while I was holding on after I called that the United Nations was doing something. But what is it what can they possibly be doing to help? What are they doing to help? What are we doing to help this?
How are we trying to control this?
How can we stop this poisoning from going on?
Well, Hazel, I think that's a great question. Maybe I'll start us off here and David can fill in. First of all, I think it's important to work really at all levels to get these harmful chemicals out of our environment, whether that's our air, water, food, including traditional foods. So, for instance, we've worked at the school board level at the Anchorage School District to get pesticides out of the school district and in place requiring least toxic pest management. We've worked at the state level to get a law passed called the Toxic Free Children's Act, which would phase out 10 harmful flame retardant chemicals that are found in everyday products that children are highly exposed to that yet don't offer any fire safety benefits. We work at the national level as well on chemicals policy reform. And the Stockholm Convention on Persistent Organic Pollutants specifically addresses the world's most toxic chemicals that are subject to this phenomenon of long-range transport because they do get carried on wind and ocean currents many hundreds and sometimes thousands of miles away from where they're manufactured and used. And they tend to accumulate in the Arctic because we have a fat-based food web. The animals and people are, all of us are insulated against the cold. And these chemicals, as Dr. Carpenter explained, are lipophilic. They tend to concentrate in the fatty tissues. And they are present in high concentrations in the Arctic because of this global distillation phenomenon or grasshopper effect, as it's also known. So the Stockholm Convention is a mechanism to phase these chemicals out. And we are very committed and have a lot of engagement in the negotiation and now implementation of that treaty and make sure that we have representation from Arctic indigenous communities so that this is not just a scientific endeavor. This is an effort to achieve health and human rights.
I would only add to that that the problem is that, the Stockholm Convention basically makes countries agree that they won't make these chemicals any longer. And in the U.S., we stopped making PCBs in 1977. North Korea still makes PCBs. Many countries phased out PCBs, but that happened over a period of time. And the fact that they persist in the environment means there's no quick solution. So we're now stuck with most of the countries of the world don't make them any longer, but we still have all these waste sites that are full of them. They're in our food supply. They're traveling all over the world. And so there's no quick fix. So what we have to do in the meantime is to try to reduce the places from which they're going into the air and migrating in the Arctic, and that is dealing with the waste sites we have here in the lower 48, the waste sites they have in China. For example, on St. Lawrence Island, given the air currents, probably transport from Asia is more important than transport from North America. That may not be true when you talk about eastern Canada and the Inuit people in eastern Canada and Greenland, but for St. Lawrence Island, it probably is more Asia. And there's no quick fix on this. So part of what is so important is that we can convey to people how they're exposed. Eating animal fat is worse than eating animal meat. And provide some information, not telling them what to do, because that doesn't work in the first place and probably is not culturally appropriate. But to provide information about how you're exposed, while at the same time we take strenuous efforts to find ways to reduce the transport of these chemicals, the use of these chemicals, and to find engineering ways to destroy these chemicals that are so widespread in our environment. It's not an easy task.
Mm-hmm. All right.
Well, thank you.
Hazel, thanks for your call. Pam, let me ask you a little bit more about what the Alaska Community Action on Toxins is doing. I know you've got a couple of other issues that we probably ought to let people be aware of.
Sure. Well, we do work on, in addition to our community-based research, we do policy work at the local level. We do a lot of grassroots organizing, educational programs, and we respond to community and individual requests for assistance. So we've worked, for instance, with communities in Southeast Alaska to reduce and eliminate aerial use of pesticides and herbicides, the communities along the rail belt to prevent and reduce the use of herbicides along the rail belt. And we also, I mentioned, we work at on policy at really all different levels. So pesticides and other issues in the local school district, statewide policy efforts through the legislature. We are also now engaged in some get out the vote efforts, knowing that if we're going to change this system of law, we have to have a better and more effective democracy. So we're really working on science advocacy, organizing, and policy at many different levels, really making sure that people are represented at the table when decisions are being made that affect their health and well-being. And we are organizing an upcoming Children's Environmental Health Summit, which will be October 5th and 6th at Alaska Pacific University. We're bringing in some wonderful nationally renowned speakers, such as David Carpenter, also Dr. Ruth Etzel, who heads up and used to work as a physician here in Alaska. She heads up the Office of Children's Health Protection at the EPA. Local people who have experience on the ground, expertise in healthcare providers, as well as scientists, policy experts, and parents and teachers who are concerned about children's environmental health.
So the public is invited. This is not just a professionals-only kind of conference?
That's right. I think we're really hoping to have a broad spectrum of people because, as we've discussed, these issues are very complex. And we want to have this conference not just be an end in itself, but we want to come out of this with a series of recommendations and actions that can help protect children's environmental health. So that's really going to take all of us. And that includes students, parents, teachers, as well as scientists and policymakers.
So that, just for listeners who might be more interested, the link to the Alaska conference is on our website as well. But also if you go to akaction.org on the internet, or you can call local number 907-222-7714. That will be October 5th and 6th at APU. All right. There's also, you sent me some information about a consensus statement that has been made recently. It's called Targeting Environmental Neurodevelopmental Risk. Can you all explain the gist of that particular document as well?
Sure. I was part of that process, which was really, I think, an unprecedented alliance of leading scientists, healthcare professionals, as well as children's health advocates that came together over a period of about 2 years and published a consensus statement in the journal Environmental Health Perspectives in July. And the consensus statement really showed agreement for the first time that today's scientific evidence supports a link between exposures to toxic chemicals in our food, air, and everyday products and children's risks for neurodevelopmental disorders. So this Project Tender really is not only a consensus statement and synthesis of scientific information, but really a call for immediate action to significantly reduce exposures to chemicals that are known to cause neurodevelopmental harm, to harm children's brain development. And these include chemicals that are well known, such as lead and mercury, but also chemicals that are less well known, such as the organophosphate pesticides that are used in many indoor and agricultural settings. It includes the flame retardants like the polybrominated diphenyl ethers, combustion-related air pollutants, the polycyclic aromatic hydrocarbons that are found in combustion of cars and in smokestacks and power plants. And then also we've talked a lot about PCBs, and certainly those are known to cause neurodevelopmental harm as well. So we highlighted these sets of chemicals as some of the examples of chemicals, but knowing that there are other chemicals that are also linked with neurodevelopmental disorders, including intellectual disabilities, autism spectrum disorder, attention deficits, hyperactivities, and other problems with children's brain development.
David, I want to get back to you since I've got a rather well-published, very knowledgeable in the research area of toxins, environmental toxins, and take advantage of you and ask a couple of questions. And if you feel like you need to speak more to what Pam has been saying, please do. But one of the things that I think anybody who reads the newspaper a little bit, there's a couple of issues that I think I need to ask. And let me start with the cell phones and cancer. And if you want to dodge that and go somewhere else, I understand. But I know
you might get there.
I know you've been doing research. So let me tell you my bias, and then you can tell me that why I'm wrong or agree or whatever. But my reading is the electromagnetic radiation from these guys are so mild that genetic changes in general, chromosome changes, which are associated with cancer pretty consistently now, seem unlikely. And yet there's recently been some data, again, suggesting that there may be nevertheless, still a problem. I think it was with experimental animals, the last one I saw. So where are we on this issue? What's the best information we can discuss today?
Well, the interesting fact is that in terms of radio frequency radiation, which is what cell phones are and Wi-Fi and cell towers and all of these things, the evidence that they cause cancer in humans is very, very strong. And it comes from multiple studies, including studies done by the World Health Organization. But nobody has really believed it because nobody had shown that cancer occurs in animals from the same exposure. It's usually the other way around. We demonstrate cancer in animals, and then we worry about cancer in people. But in my judgment, that evidence for a relationship to cancer is very strong. And just a couple of months ago, the National Toxicology Program came out with the results of one of the most expensive studies they've ever done, where rats and mice were exposed to cell phone frequency electromagnetic fields. And what they found in rats, but not in the mice, that the rats got the same cancers that people get. That is, glioma is a kind of brain cancer, and schwannomas, which is a cancer of glial cells in the peripheral nervous system. The issue isn't going to go away because, and again, I should say, while I'm convinced that excessive use of your cell phone will cause brain cancer, increase your risk of brain cancer, relative to the risk of many other things in our environment, this is a small one, but it's still one that we all should be aware of, and it's so easy to take some precautions that are not life-distressing. They're so easy to do that it's stupid not to take cautions. Don't use your cell phone in a Wi-Fi environment too too much. Use a wired earpiece. Use your landline. You know, this interview is on a landline because cell phones don't give good reception. But the problem is that we're in a wireless world, and we all benefit from that. But excessive use is associated with elevated disease, and that includes brain cancer.
I don't want to belabor this, but I kind of looked real quickly, and I would have expected that the incidence of brain cancers in humans would be increasing, especially since the use of cell phones. But what I looked at initially did not seem to demonstrate that there's much evidence that, at least in humans, that there's increasing cancers of the central nervous system since the advent of cell phones. Am I wrong about that, or is that?
No, you're not really wrong. There's some increase, and the increase is greatest in adolescents,
okay,
which are the group that really are using cell phones a lot. But the latency for ionizing radiation and increased brain cancer is about 30 years.
Ah, okay.
And so we have not been using cell phones that much 30 years ago. So the concern that we all have that work in this area is that we're going to see dramatic increases in the future because there's so much added Wi-Fi, cell phone, wireless, this and that. It's one of these issues where there's a lot of controversy. There certainly are a lot of uncertainties in terms of mechanisms and even in terms of the results, but it's an area where the precautionary principle, which we haven't gotten to yet, it's a good segue to the precautionary principle.
Well, let's talk about that. I think that way of reasoning makes sense, and not only in this, but it makes sense in medicine. It makes sense when we talk about global warming. It makes sense in a lot of ways. What do we mean by the precautionary principle?
Well, the precautionary principle basically says when you have some evidence, but it's not 100%, that something causes disease, should you wait until you can count the bodies, or should you take reasonable precautions to reduce your exposure before, you know, it's absolutely 100% certain, before the International Agency for Research on Cancer says cell phones cause cancer and therefore you shouldn't use them? Should you maybe moderate your use in the short term because of some evidence that it's dangerous in excess? And this applies to absolutely everything where we have uncertainties. It applies to chemicals that cause endocrine disruption. It applies to certainly chemicals that cause cancer, chemicals that increase risk of heart disease and diabetes. If there's some evidence, albeit not 100% proof, is it logical and reasonable to try to take some steps to reduce your exposure? From my perspective as a public health physician, I say absolutely yes.
Pam, you would, agree, and I used the idea of the precautionary principle even with global warming, which may not immediately hit people with a health issue, but the same argument might be
given. It is a health issue without question.
Okay, it is a health issue. So that maybe we are, maybe we aren't warming, but why don't we, if we mess up and it is and we don't think so, the consequences could be pretty severe. That's another example of what you're saying with the precautionary principle, I guess.
Absolutely.
Sure, and I think that's the precautionary principle is something that really guides our work every day at Alaska Community Action on Toxics. It's a core value because it's a very simple thing. It's better safe than sorry. And parents apply it every day, whether it's, you know, putting their child in a car seat or
right.
putting a gate at the top of a set of stairs. Right. It's a better safe than sorry approach. And it really makes sense that even in the face of incomplete evidence, if we have evidence, it seems reasonable and prudent that we have also the responsibility to act to protect.
What else do we need to talk about? What is there another issue that in the next, we've got about 4 minutes to be honest, that I'll let you all tell me what we should mention without me drumming up another issue, which I've got plenty of, but I want to ask you all, is there something you think we ought to particularly address, particularly maybe related to Alaska?
Well, I think there are some issues of concern here in Alaska where children have higher exposures because of this phenomenon of global transport and accumulation of chemicals in the Arctic. We also have higher exposures, I believe, because our indoor environment is more insulated against the cold, less well ventilated. So children can be more highly exposed to chemicals that are accumulating in household dust that leach out of household products such as furniture and toys and electronics. So those are some concerns. And one reason that we're having this Children's Environmental Health Summit is that in many ways, children in Alaska and the Arctic generally are more vulnerable. We certainly have some patterns of disease that I'm very concerned about. For instance, Alaska has the highest rate of birth defects in the country. Alaska infants have twice the incidence of birth defects than infants in the lower 48. And Alaska Native infants have even higher rates than white children in Alaska. So that's a cause for concern. Everywhere we go in Alaska, in rural communities, we hear concerns about cancer, and in particular childhood cancers, which seem to be on the rise in terms of incidence. And we're seeing cancers in children at younger and younger ages. So these are just some of the causes for concern and the reason that we're pulling together this Children's Health Summit so we can understand the current knowledge, the state of science, as well as bring together a variety of people, including healthcare professionals, to find ways that we can reduce incidence of exposure that might result in health disparities.
David, we've got a minute and a half or so. I'll let you end with some wisdom here.
Well, I second everything Pam just said. Let me just describe a little bit a conference we had in Halifax, Canada, a year ago that looked at cancer and asked the question about all these chemicals that suddenly we have in our environment that we use every day. The chemicals in plastics, the chemicals in personal care products, perfumes and body lotions and so forth. Many of those chemicals have not been shown to cause cancer. But when we ask people that study the effects of these chemicals, we find that they all do the same kinds of things in cells, in animals, and even in the human body that chemicals that are known to cause cancer do. So I think our conclusion was that, you know, you shouldn't wait till something is known to cause cancer. We have so many chemicals in our environment today that we didn't have 30 years ago, certainly didn't have 100 years ago. And many of these are beneficial to our lifestyle, but they also may be detrimental to our health. And we really need to step back a bit and say, you know, is this plastic thing that I stole my food in and put it in the microwave, is it really good for me? Is it causing some harm to me and to my family and to my children? And this is a real challenge for our generation.
Well, let me just first to end the program say thanks to both of you, Pam Miller, the Executive Director of Alaska Community Action on Toxics, and David Carpenter, MD, Director of the Institute of Health and Environment at the University of at Albany. I really appreciate the education today. Thank
you. You're welcome. Thank you.
Very good to talk to you.
Next, if you want to continue this discussion, you can join KSK on Facebook, and you can find that link at alaskapublic.org. Next week, we'll continue our program, and our listeners will be brought up to date on prostate cancer, so why not join us at 2 p.m. on September 19th. David Waldron was today's engineer. Eric Bork is our web editor. I'm Dr. Thad Woodard. Have a great day.
Line 1 is a production of Alaska Public Media, which is solely responsible for its content. Views expressed are those of the host and participants and do not reflect the underwriters or KSKA. Learn more about Line 1 and listen online at alaskapublic.org. Life Informed. This is Alaska Public Media.